Welcome to the Edu All-Stars Podcast.
Hey guys, and welcome to the 74th episode of Edu All-Stars. My name is Todd Nessaloni, and you can find me on Twitter at TechNinjaTodd.
And my name is Chris Kessler. You can find me on Twitter at IamKessler. Hope everyone had a great Thanksgiving. I had a couple weeks off. I know I found myself up in New York. We went out with my wife on vacation for a couple of days, and then got sick on the way back, unfortunately, and so I've been laid up in bed for the last few days, but I'm feeling good now, ready to get back into the swing of things for at least a few weeks until Christmas comes around.
Well, and as you listen to this week's episode, we encourage you to tweet out using the EduAllStars hashtag. We love seeing the conversations and hearing about the different kind of things that stick out to you. We're excited about this week's guest, Josh Stumpenhorst, who is a 6th grade language arts and social sciences teacher at Lincoln Junior High in Naperville, Illinois. He has a master's degree in curriculum and instruction, as well as a national board certification in early adolescent social sciences. He's been recognized by ISTE as a member of the Emerging Leader Class of 2011, and he's been recognized as the 2012 Illinois Teacher of the Year. So, Josh, thanks for coming on with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I'm pumped.
Well, the best place we always like to start with our guests is just kind of hearing a little bit about their journey and background and how they got into education.
That's a great question. Wow, I think my journey probably went back to when I was in school, which I think is pretty common for most teachers when you look back at, you know, an influential teacher you might have had. I grew up in a very small community. I think we had around 900 people in town. So my building was a K-12 building. I graduated with about 22, 23 kids in my class. So I was always really, I had close personal connections with my teachers. You know, I worked with them in the summers, and I don't know, something about that always kind of clicked with me. But I actually went to college to be a journalist major. I wanted to be on SportsCenter, be like Stuart Scott, come up with those, you know, witty catchphrases and do all that kind of stuff. And then I had a couple experiences doing some volunteer work, working with a program where we essentially taught summer school to some inner city Chicago kids. And it just kind of clicked for me that this is where I wanted to be and this is what I wanted to do. And so I did my 4 years and got my degree, walked into the exact same position I'm doing now, coaching 2 sports, teaching LA and social studies. So that's kind of, that's it in a nutshell.
So have you always been with 6th grade?
Yep. I student taught in the same building, but I actually student taught 7th grade, but I've taught 6th grade. This is my 12th year in the same building, same team, same setting, so it's kind of nice.
Being a middle school teacher myself, do you notice a difference between 7th and 6th graders when you did that?
Or? Oh, for sure. I say 7th grade's got it easy because 6th grade, we get them right off the boat. You know, they don't know how to open a combo locker. We spend the first month of school not teaching a darn thing but how to, you know, blow your nose when you're crying and get that locker open and get to class on time. So 7th grade, you know, the kids kind of got it figured out. In 8th grade, that transition to high school is tough too. But, yeah, I think 6th grade's, you know, we got to teach them everything. We've got to teach them how to go through the lunch line. You know, every single thing that's new to them in the building, you know, we have to teach them, you know. And it's so, but it's exciting, and they come in so deer in headlights. It's really a lot of fun.
Yeah, I really loved it. Go ahead, Todd.
Well, no, you go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say, I really loved my years teaching 6th grade. They were just, because of that, and then they still, like, hugged you, you know, when they did well on something, and they still were, like, you know, super excited about school. Now I'm in 8th grade, and they're like, eh, whatever.
Exactly. They still think you're a little godlike, you know what I
mean?
That's right.
I was still, like, a superhero walking into class, and now they're like, eh, it's Mr. Kessler, eh,
whatever.
Josh, what sports do you coach?
I'm in the middle of my boys' basketball season, and I also coach track. I did coach girls' basketball for a number of years, but between having the kids of my own, my wife, it's just the schedule is too tough, so I just do the boys' basketball and the track as well in the spring.
So let's talk a little bit about the innovation days you do in your classroom. Just tell us a little bit about more what that looks like and just kind of how that came to be.
You know, we did I don't even remember how many years ago. It was probably 4 or 5 years ago now. We did a little bit of a, I wouldn't even say it a book study, but we looked at the RSA Animate video from Dan Pink's book, Drive, and just the whole concepts of motivation, what motivates humans, and just had a lot of conversations as a staff about, you know, how does that, what are the implications for kids? You know, even though sometimes our kids don't act very human-like, we have to think that the same principles that apply to adults apply to kids. And we had a 7th grade teacher, Matt Langus, who's a fantastic teacher and a good friend of mine, and he actually tried an innovation day with his team. So about 100 kids. And the kids were given free rein for the day. What are you passionate about? What do you want to learn about? And I remember walking through the halls in his, you know, when he was doing this with the kids and, you know, almost got kicked in the face. One of the girls was doing some ballet, you know, choreographing that in the hallway. Kids were building stuff. Kids were inventing. They were creating all kinds of stuff, writing, you know, story, just you name it. And so the sixth grade team and myself, we decided, hey, let's try this with our entire grade level. So we had about 300 kids, a little over 300 that year, that first year, which was, this will be year five this year when we do it. And it was amazing. I mean, the stuff the kids created and, you know, kept them focused and motivated and engaged for an entire day was pretty powerful. And then we kind of expanded that, and I'm sure you guys are familiar with Genius Hour, which kind of has become a little more trendy. We started it with passion projects, which is the exact same thing, you know, tomato, tomato. And so we still do that. I still do that today in my class on a weekly basis. And it's funny, you know, every year is a little different. This year I've got kids that are just so stinking smart. I mean, I got probably 15 kids in my language arts class that are smarter than I am, and from an IQ standpoint, and I'm not embarrassed to say that. And so that's kind of the where we've gone. I mean, we've had guest speakers. We had Reed Timmer, the Storm Chaser from Discovery Education, come in and do a keynote to kick off our third innovation day, which was just, oh, man, I can't even tell you. I don't know that I could ever top that, you know. It's been pretty – so it's been great, you know, and I've helped a lot of schools. A lot of people call me up to help them, you know, kind of get it off the ground. The funny thing is Dan Pink calls me. You know, I actually helped his own children's principal get an innovation day started at their school. Which I think is kind of funny. So that's kind of where it came from, and it just really goes back to the whole notion that, you know, if you have little kids, they're really motivated by curiosity and questions, and so often in school we just rip that from kids. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to give that back, and that's really what that day is about. And we had a deputy superintendent, it was last year, the year before, he said, you know, in his 40-plus years in education, he's never seen kids that engaged and motivated to learn about something at school. So to me, that's an endorsement we're doing something right.
Sure.
So when you think of something like this, obviously it's going to take a whole day of instruction. How'd you get your whole campus on board?
I don't have the whole campus on board. I just have sixth grade.
Oh. Hey, well,
you know, the first year we did it, we had pretty much everyone was on board because nobody knew any better. So they just said, oh, yeah, we'll give this a try. And I'll be honest, there are some outliers that don't like it. Because it's not graded, it's not, you know, in the curriculum or whatever. And I'll be honest, I could tell you every single project that's some stupid Common Core standard if I really wanted to. I mean, we all know that. So yeah, I do have people, but it's taken on kind of a life of its own that while this is an unintended kind of thing, the passive-aggressive peer pressure that if you're that one teacher or that one team that doesn't do it, you're going to look pretty bad because all the kids – vast majority of them talk about that being their crowning moment of sixth grade, that was the day they say that was the best day. You know, I built I built something, and they talk about that and they remember that forever. And so seventh and eighth grade has not bought into it. They have not bought into it. And I don't know the reason. They just think it's a sixth grade thing. I'm not real sure. We do have some teachers dabbling with the Genius Hour concept. So I guess that's a step in the right direction.
So if there were some teachers listening who were interested in doing an innovation day, would they just contact you, or do you have something on your site that has kind of a rundown of what it looks like?
I posted on my blog about it, but certainly you connect with me on Twitter. I'm happy to help anybody. I use a very simple planning sheet, and I'm happy to share that with anybody we've created and kind of, you know, build it to what you need. But it's really, really simple. Hey, kids, you're going to get a day to learn about whatever you want. You need to create something and share something. That's the directions. You know, I mean, it's as simple as that sounds, that's really what it is. Yeah. But certainly any teacher wants to reach out, I am more than happy, and I love seeing that idea spread. So please do reach out and get a hold of me.
Awesome. Well, you know, in 2012, you were recognized as the Illinois Teacher of the Year. Can you kind of tell our listeners a little bit about how that came about and what that experience was like?
Oh, boy. I got lucky, I guess. I don't know. You know, it's one of those things where I was nominated by, and this is going to sound, I'll be totally honest, I was in the process of, I really wanted to go to ISTE, okay? I'd never gone. And so I applied for my principal nominated me for their emerging leader, which, as you know, I did receive as part of that class. And my principal said, well, hey, why don't I nominate you for our Those Who Excel, which is our Teacher of the Year program within our district, because that'll look good on your resume. Now, she never said, oh, you'd be really deserving. Now, maybe I did. You know, I get it. So that was why it originally happened. And then the district decided I was the best candidate for the entire district to be sent on to the state. And then the rest was history. I became the Illinois Teacher of the Year, which, you know, looking back on it, started kind of humorously. And then before you know it, I'm throwing out a pitch at Wrigley and meeting the president. So I guess it worked out all right for me.
Cool.
So but the whole process was pretty amazing to sit and with, you know, 53 other teachers, you know, the 50 states plus American Samoa, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, and like talk about a powerhouse of people and every walk of life, every, you know, setting and context within public and private education. It just opened my eyes. I thought I knew some things. But I grew and more and learned more as a teacher that year just from sitting down at a bar over a beer with these people, because it was just, I'm sure you can imagine, just mind-boggling.
Sure. What are some of your favorite technology tools to use in your own classroom?
Oh, that's a great question. Whatever works for the kids is typically my answer. I think that a lot of times, and this has kind of always been one of my frustrations, I go to a lot of tech conferences, you know, and you look at the sessions that are always full are the top 25 iPad apps for, you know, kindergartners. There's 4,000 people in there. But then you go listen to somebody talk about really changing the way we look at, you know, the use of devices, the use of technology, and there'll be three people in there, and it'll be a dynamite, you know, presentation. So I always hesitate on listing a few. When I talk about for teachers in terms of professional growth, my number one tool is always going to be anything social media related to kind of connect you to people smarter than you, because I know there's always people smarter than me, and I want to learn from them. But with kids, it's so hard to pick one thing, because in my ELA class, my language arts class, kids are using all kinds of stuff. I've got kids on, you know, Scratch writing programming. I've got kids, you know, just all over the place. I don't know that I could pick one single thing. I'm really, right now, if I'm going to name one thing, Minecraft has been really big in my class this year. I dabbled with it last year, and I'm really having kids do a lot of building and creating within our social studies context. So when we talk about the manorial system in medieval Europe, we're not going to talk about it. I want you to research it and build it. And talk about taking that to kind of a different level. And so that would, I guess, would be one that is a new one for me. But there's just, oh my gosh, you throw a stick, you'll hit 100 things. There's just so much out there. And our district is in the middle of piloting and potentially, hopefully, moving to a one-to-one initiative next year, which is going to change everything, I think, in a good and a bad way. But it's going to be, you know, you ask me that question in a year from now, I'm probably going to have a much different answer depending on what device we go with and what ecosystem we're living in.
Yeah, sure.
Now, I know you mentioned Sportscaster at the top of the episode, but what if you weren't a teacher, is that what you think you'd be?
I probably would be. I'd probably be a writer, sports writer. When I was in high school, funny story, I wrote for our local paper when in a town of 900, you can't really be too anonymous. So I actually had a fake name that I wrote under. So when I was covering sports, especially when I was playing high school basketball, I was covering our own games, and our coach would always be like, who is this guy that knows what I'm saying at halftime? Like, he didn't know it was me, and it was always kind of funny, and to this day, I never told him that I was the one writing, though I think my parents were the only ones that knew that it was me.
That's awesome.
So tell us a little bit about, sorry, Chris, tell us a little about your journey with getting on social media and using that to connect and improve your practice.
You know, it's pretty simple, and I think a lot of people would have a similar story. I was at a tech conference, and my, you know, true story, John Orrick, I don't know if you guys know John, he's an amazing guy, he's on Twitter, Jay Orrick, but he was doing a session on Twitter, and this was probably going on probably four years ago, and I had no interest in Twitter. I barely knew what it was. I thought it was LeBron James and Kim Kardashian. I really didn't think anything of it. I was just sat in the room because my battery was dying, and it was a fairly open room with an open outlet. We all know that game, right?
Yep.
So I was sitting there plugged in, and I just sit and listen to him talk, and I'm kind of like, I didn't get it. I signed up for an account because he kind of shamed us into it at that point, which was a good thing. And I just started following, you know, like Shaquille O'Neal and Bill Gates and a bunch of other random people, Steve Martin, who I still follow because he's hilarious. And then I went to ISTE, and I was sitting there at ISTE in Denver, and I was in a workshop, and there was a woman sitting next to me, and I was totally creeping on her because she had TweetDeck up. And I'm just watching her share this stuff out, and I just said, what in the world are you doing? So she explained to me how she was sharing resources and how using the hashtag there was stuff coming in from all these different sessions. And then it kind of clicked for me, and I went, oh, And then I sat in a I had a conversation with Steve Dembo, who I think the world of as well, and was seeing how he was using it, and it just kind of took off from there, and I started participating in EdChat, and the rest is just kind of history, and I use it to connect when I need to, and you know, but it's there if I have to step away too. And I have found it to be pretty powerful to just connect myself with just so many smart people.
Do you have any chats that you attend on a weekly basis or anything or anymore?
Weekly, not as much, to be honest with you. When I just don't have the time. You know, it sounds horrible. I hop in when I can. I always try to check in on social studies chat because I do like those guys, and I think they have a great chat going. Mm-hmm. And the one that I'm probably on the most is the IL-Ed chat, which is the Illinois Educators chat, because they're really talking about things that are pertinent to me and to my kids and that kind of stuff. And then I moderate our school district within the last couple of months has been really pushing social media, I've been hosting a chat within our district, and so we've been doing that, and it's been pretty powerful to show our cabinet members and our school board members that this isn't just a stupid fad, that this is something that's actually changing professional practice in our district, which is good. And EdChat I used to be real active on, but to be honest, it's too big of a beast now. I don't find it as productive as it once was. Mm-hmm. And I know Tom and Steve will probably kill me for saying that, but I prefer the side conversations I have with three or four people than, throwing myself into that mess right now. But I always tell new people to go there to at least see it, because I think there's a lot of learning that goes on there. But, that's like drinking from a fire hose right there.
Yeah, for sure it is. So how do you motivate, students in your class that may be unmotivated?
That's a good question. I have an entire book or chapter in my book about that. But the number one reason I think as a teacher you have to find out why they're not motivated, and there's so many answers to that question. They hate you. They don't like you as a person, so they're not motivated to do your work. That's a problem we often see. And finding out why they don't like you, why they don't like the content, how do we motivate that? I think a lot of kids have been brainwashed by the time I see them in sixth grade, that they have to do it this way. There's a recipe to follow, and so they've been taught that way their entire career. And so I have found one of the biggest motivators for sixth grade, anyway, is providing autonomy and choice. Somehow creating that opportunity for them to, all right, you know what, you're not all going to make a PowerPoint. Here's the content. We're going to create a project. If you want it to look like a PowerPoint, you want to create a game, you want to build something, whatever it is, I don't care. I just want that end product, and I found that to be pretty motivating. And I teach a content that most kids could care less about, social studies. I mean, talk about my wife would fall asleep if History Channel's on. So, but I find that choice has been a real powerful motivator. But it's one of those things where you can't just say, "Here's your, do whatever you want," because kids have been brainwashed. If you say that, every kid will turn in either an essay or a PowerPoint.
It's true.
They don't know that.
Yeah, even in eighth grade, I mean, I'm seeing the same things. It's like, just to get them to get away from PowerPoint and Prezi. I mean, they know Prezi, and they think, well, okay, well, if it's not PowerPoint, I'll do a Prezi. Well, no, there's other things than that.
Yeah, you got to get the Dramamine ready if you got those novice Prezi users, though.
Yeah, for sure, absolutely.
So, Josh, you mentioned your book. Why don't you tell our readers about your book first before I move into the next question?
I have a book with Corwin. It's called The New Teacher Revolution. And the subtitle is Educating a New Generation of Learners, or Educating for a New Generation of Learners. And I really poured my heart and soul into what I believe we are screwing up in education, how we can fix it. And really couching it underneath this whole belief that the classroom teachers are responsible and that we can create a revolution to change and make things better for kids. And it's really just kind of a culmination of 12 years of teaching, but also 9 years of being a parent. And looking at the ways that kids are being really successful in my class as well as my own children in ways that we're not. And so it's really, a challenge to the status quo and a lot of the things that we have had as time held, traditions in education. I'm excited about it. I just got my book covers this week, so hopefully that'll get summed up and it'll be available, give or take, end of February, early March.
Cool. That's exciting.
Yeah, I'm pretty pumped.
So, speaking of your book, what are some books that you have read recently or that you're currently reading that you would recommend to somebody else?
One I'm actually currently reading is by Ket O'Connor, and I'm going to mess up the title I always do. It's about grading. The Grader's Toolkit or something like that. It's got a green cover. It's a fantastic book. It's escaping me right now. But it really evaluates the traditional grading systems that are out there and really challenges how we look at what a grade means and evaluate how we can use grading and assessing to more accurately reflect learning and actually lead to learning and rather than just be kind of an output of learning. So that's one I'm looking at right now. And I just picked up, I'm trying to think of the title. It's a Gary Steger book. It's about the maker movement. And I've been just kind of flipping through that. I'm kind of excited to get into that one. We're doing a book club at school about that, and I'm kind of pumped about that one right now.
That's cool.
What's something, just looking back over the last few years, what's something you're most proud of accomplishing?
I think my most proud accomplishments, every single year when a kid says they don't hate school anymore, and they did, like that's always my greatest accomplishment. And I think about that from my perspective as a father. You know, every year as a parent, you get these little, you know, cute worksheets from the elementary school teachers, like fill out all these things about your kid. And there's always that question of what are your goals for the year? And my wife's a reading specialist, so she's always like, well, they need to improve their MAP score. And I say, no. Our goal for the year is for our sons to love school in May as much as they do in August. And so that's always kind of one of my big goals and what I do is that if I can get a kid to love my content, love coming to school at the end of the year as much as they do or more than they do at the beginning, then that's the win for me, and that's my greatest accomplishment. You know, all the awards, it's funny, people ask, where's your trophy and certificate? I don't have any of that. It's in a file cabinet stuck somewhere. I never have that out. I don't care about that, you know. I get a real big kick out of that. And when I get, you know, letters from kids as they've moved up or when I see them become teachers or move into the careers, you know, as my kids are starting to get, you know, the kids I've taught have graduated college and high school and they come back, that's just the greatest accomplishment when a kid succeeds, you know, especially the ones that you were worried about, you know, the ones that you thought, shoot, this kid's going down the wrong path.
Yeah.
And when you hear them do well, that's the best right there.
So when you're having a really rough day, what is something that you do to recenter yourself?
I go for a run and I have a beer.
Good for you. Good for you.
I do run every single day, and that's a tremendous meditation for me. And I do it in the morning, so it kind of sets my day right. I don't have days that get to me. You know, the worst day, I still walk out of there going, you know what, it could be a lot worse, you know, and I still love what I do, and I still have fun with it. I have a sense of humor with it, so I'm pretty easy to laugh at things. But I do, you know, I do keep, you know, those notes from kids that make you feel good and that kind of stuff. I do have a drawer of those. Just, you know, every once in a while, it's kind of fun to pull those out. You know, you think about that knucklehead, but he wrote you a really nice letter, and that's, you know, makes you feel good. So, yeah, those are always good. And you'll hop on social media and you can find people that have a lot worse than you and a lot better, so you don't feel so bad about yourself.
Yeah, definitely. What about something that the biggest thing you've learned maybe over the last year? Something that maybe you have failed at or just a lesson that you've learned along the way?
One of the things that I think I've known this, but it constantly gets reinforced and it's kind of a scary thing, is the tremendous impact that adults have on kids and how much we are responsible for screwing kids up in a lot of different ways. And I mean that from a teacher perspective and a parent. And I use this as an example I had last year. I had probably one of the roughest groups of kids that I've ever had in my entire career. It's one of those groups where if you were in your first year, you would think long and hard about coming back the next year. And from every end of every possible scenario you could imagine, from challenges of kids with police records to everything in between. But in going through that year and looking at the adults in these kids' lives, it just great sadness to look at. And we know this. We know that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree in most cases. I know that's a stereotype, but there's a lot of truth to that. And what does that say for my kids? I'm not sure yet. But but I think that, you know, I knew that, but last year was a real harsh reality check for me in looking at, I can try as hard as I can, give every ounce of my being to a kid, and it may not make a darn bit of difference. You know, I was at a wedding probably about a year ago with my younger brother, who's not a teacher. And he said, why do you try so hard? You're not going to help every one of them. You can't help every one of them. And I thought about that, and I said, you know, you're right. You are exactly right, but I don't know which ones those are.
Right.
And that's the key. And I told him that, and he didn't like that answer, but that's the truth. And so last year I really learned that, it as sad as it was, I could invest my entire life and time for an entire school year in a kid, but because of the parents and the adults and their lives at home, nothing I was going to do was going to change that. And that's a tough reality. But I don't think that is a cop-out. I think that's just a way to try harder because you don't know which kid it's going to click for.
Yeah, I think that's a good outlook to have on it. And we were having that little conversation before we got on the air, before you actually joined us. And mm-hmm. I've got a little girl myself this year that is just like, I mean, she hates me, she hates school, she hates life. I'm not cracking this kid no matter what kind of cool, awesome teacher I am. But at the same time, I don't know. Down the road, she, 10 years down the road, she may come back and say that, I was the one that, changed her life or whatever, just for being there.
Yeah, you never know.
And I love that you say that because, I think we have to be careful of teachers of holding ourselves responsible too for every kid, because I think sometimes we can beat ourselves down of why couldn't I get to that kid? But it's like you said, because there's so many other factors outside of their school day that you could be the best teacher they ever have, but they may be so damaged or so angrier at everything that what you do may have leave some lasting marks, but it may not change that child into a dream that you see on television movies by the end of the school year.
Yeah, well, and you never know, because that impact may not manifest for years.
Yeah, I used to have this assistant principal would tell us all the time. It's like you're just planting seeds in middle school, and those may not grow for many, many years. And it's just that's the unfortunate business of being in middle school. You don't necessarily reap your own water that you're pouring on them.
No, and some of them need water because they smell.
Yes, they do.
Well, that's another middle school thing.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
Well, Josh, what do you think is one of the biggest challenges that you face in your job?
I think it changes every year. If you would ask me that 2-3 years ago, it would be an ineffective administrator is one of the biggest challenges to my job. I was ready to leave the profession because of a very incompetent and ineffective, and I say that very openly, and I don't care. This year, that's not the case. There's a new sheriff in town, and I've never been more supported, encouraged, and empowered than by the administrative team I have right now. The biggest challenge I face now is Common Core implementation. That's kind of the elephant in the room right now with a lot of us. I don't have an issue with the standards, and I know that's not a popular view because I know there's such a line in the sand about that. As an Illinois teacher, the standards that we're using now are better than what we've had. So I'm totally fine with the standards, and I think we need standards to provide a guide, a guide for us. The implementation, however, I'm seeing some issues. I think it's being rushed. I think people are buying a bunch of crap resources just because they got the sticker on the front. I'm nervous about the PARC assessment, both as a teacher and a parent. My third grade son is going to take a PARC assessment this year, and I don't know whether that's going to test his ability to, his learning, or it's going to test his tech skills, attention skills, and a whole lot of those other things. And so that's my biggest challenge right now, is trying to make sense of that and implement it with, integrity, but also not, to use the example, we're using this Lucy Calkins writing framework in our school. I think it was New York that had it and kicked it out, and a lot of schools are kind of pushed back on it. It's actually quite funny if you Google her name and see some of the images that people have created. but anyways, we're using this, and our kids are getting to be better writers because of it. They're writing their rear ends off. And so my fear is, with a lot of this implementation, these programs people are putting in place is, we might increase scores, but kids are going to hate it. Kids are going to be better writers by the end of the year, but they're never going to write because they hate writing. Mm-hmm. And so I find that to be very challenging because on one end, the teacher had, I think, these kids are going to be better writers. That's awesome. But they hate writing. So how is that really a benefit? So I'm trying to me, that's a challenge right now. And that's why the beauty of social studies is it's kind of the forgotten stepchild of the curriculum family. Nobody cares about it. It's not tested. So I can kind of do what I want. I can really push the kids in the direction I think they need to be in. With civics and all these other things that are so important in social sciences. So that's my biggest challenge right now is the implementation of these new standards, as I know a lot of people would probably echo that around the country.
Well, you know, and I love the point that you bring up of that you could increase scores by doing certain things, but you're not building a love for that subject area. It looks great on paper, but the kids hate doing it on their own. And I think that's something that's often forgot about people who aren't in the trenches doing it is that, I mean, and that's the battle we're facing right now at the campus I'm at, is I know what to do to get scores up, and that's drill and kill a test, and I can do that like no other, but that's not going to increase learning on the campus. No. So it's kind of that catch-22 that you're caught in the middle of.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I'm sitting with my son just tonight, and he was working on his times tables. And, you know, they do that's all timed. And I remember doing that as a kid, and I was very good at it because if I got it in a certain amount of time, I could play Oregon Trail. So I could go shoot buffalo. So I got real good at math because of Oregon Trail. And I see him, and he understands the concepts, but his speed isn't there. And so I fear he's going to develop a hatred of math because he can't do it fast enough. And so it's tough. And so I see it in my own house where my other son doesn't have that problem. So it's tough. You're right, because you want them to succeed, but at what cost? And how do we measure success? And it's not in a bubble sheet, yet every state and district, that's how they're measuring you, you know, your abilities and your success or failure as a teacher. And in our state, that's going to be tied into our evaluations next year, is how kids do on these assessments. And that's, you know, I have mixed feelings on that. I think, yes, I should be responsible for getting kids to learn, but I think there's a lot of ways to measure that, not just, you know, that one isolated test. So yeah, it's nervous. It's nerve-wracking for a lot of teachers, and I'm afraid it's going to push a lot of good teachers out.
If you could go back and see yourself maybe as a first-year teacher, what advice would you give yourself?
Oh, man, I would say I'm sorry to the kids, first off, because I didn't know what I was doing. I still remember the first group of kids I had. I was a social studies guy. That was what my degree was in college. And I was going to be a history teacher. And then my senior year, spring term, I was all locked up. I was a track athlete in college, so I was taking that as a class. I was going to take a bowling class and a jogging class, and that was going to be my final term of college. So I was pumped and ready for that. And I applied for a teaching job that was a split with an LA position, and I didn't have that endorsement. So I had to cancel all of those classes and take a bunch of English courses. So if you guys teach English, you know that no college English course prepares you for teaching junior high English. So I think that if I were to go back, I would say, you know, beef up on your young adult literature for one. And then the second thing is, I don't think I recognize the power of relationship building with kids and with parents or even colleagues in my first couple of years. I think a lot of new teachers have this fear that if they ask questions, the assumption is they don't know what they're doing. And so a lot of teachers, especially in the new years, become very isolated in teaching in their silos because they either A, are afraid that somebody will find them out and they are not, you know, as competent as their resume and their interview made them seem like they could be or they should be, or they are afraid that the parents might see, oh, this new teacher doesn't know what they're doing. And they're afraid to show their mistakes. And so I think that if I were to go back, I would definitely be way more transparent in what I was doing and seek help. And that feedback that I do now from my colleagues, from my students, and from my parents, because I just find that that is such a valuable tool that, frankly, I was scared to even look or, you know, pull my head up out of the sand that first year or three.
So, Josh, one of the questions that we always like to end on with our guests is, what is something that you're really passionate about right now?
Ooh, boy, that's a good question. Wow, I don't know if I have an answer. What am I really fired up about right now, other than how bad the Bears are?
They're pretty bad. They are pretty bad.
Oh, gosh. The best thing about this Sunday is there was no Bears to get upset about. They already screwed up Thanksgiving for us. You know, I think that I'm really passionate. I'm really excited about, you know, what I'm doing in the classroom with kids is that I feel as though I'm at a point in my career where I'm very comfortable with what I'm doing, not in a stagnant way, but I really, and I'm at a point with my content, especially in social studies, where I can take it to a deeper level with kids, and I can really connect with kids. And we're using a lot of social media. Kids are excited about using KidBlog and putting their content on our YouTube channel. And I'm really excited about sharing my kids' work and their genius with the world, which I wasn't doing as much before, and I'm really doing a lot of now. You know, we have in-class Socratic seminars, I'm tweeting out, you know, when the kids are discussing. And it's really neat to see the interaction of the kids. Oh, wait a minute, somebody commented on, something I said in the discussion. I mean, they're really fired up about that. And so I'm really excited about that, and I'm excited about the potential that, you know, that social media realm can provide that authentic audience for kids that they never before had. You know, the refrigerator is no longer the space in which student work should be shared. You know, if that's it, then we're not doing a good enough job, and kids need an audience well beyond that. So I'm really excited about that, and I think that it's just going to continue to get easier and better and just allow kids to see their true potential in, you know, connecting with the world.
Speaking of connections, how can people connect with you?
The easiest way is my entire online universe revolves around Stump Teacher. So my Twitter handle is Stump Teacher. That's my Gmail. It's my YouTube. So that, if you can remember that, and my name is not exactly common, so if you just Google my name, you're going to find me pretty easily.
Yeah, it's awesome. If you want to connect with us, you can connect with us at EduAllStarsHQ on Twitter, and then we use the hashtag EduAllStars. You can also find episodes at EduAllStars.com or search out EduAllStars with no spaces on iTunes. Thank you so much for joining us this Sunday evening. We had a great conversation. I got to know you a little better, and I wasn't very familiar with you before we got started, so this is a great connection that we made. Appreciate that.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
And we encourage all of our listeners to join us for our next episode as we interview 12-year-old H.G. Sanzastri from London next week. So you'll definitely want to check that out. Thanks again, Josh, and we will talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, guys.